Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am joined today by three of Bruegel's younger researchers. We have with us Maria Catarina Loro, Tilman Schenk, and Teo Storella. And I am so excited to have you guys on the show to talk about the future of economics and what are going to be the questions and the problems and the policy solutions that we're going to be dealing with for a long time. So often in economics, we hear either from people who are currently in big fancy jobs or people who used to have big fancy jobs, which means they are older, they are at later stages of their career. I'm very happy to have these incredibly talented colleagues who are at earlier stage of their career to tell us about what's important, why it matters, and what we might want to do about it. With that out of the way, let me first go to Catarina, who is going to talk to us about demographics and the challenge that poses.
Well, thank you, Rebecca, for having us. Well, I'd like to start by telling you why I find this subject so interesting. On a personal level, when I was growing up, I was told the Malthusian story of demographics. So when I was in school, we were told that one of the greatest issues of the future of the population would be that we would have too many people in this world. And I was scared. I remember that we were told that this would bring all of these issues with resource scarcity, climate change, even starvation. This was a big topic. We were showed documentaries. I was scared. And what I find so fascinating is that in 15 years, the narrative changed completely. And now we're facing the opposite issue. And I think that one example is China. We all know China's famous one-child policy that was introduced in the late 70s, and this was reversed nearly 10 years ago, and now China is doing the opposite. Now China has pronatal policies to incentivize people to have more children because this is starting to become a challenge. And this is not just a Chinese story. This is happening pretty much all over in the world, actually. So for the first time in history, we are seeing projections saying that the total of the world population might start to decline. And this is the first time, not even in pandemics, not even in wars. This is the first time that we're seeing projections saying, hey, in 100 years from now, the world is going to start to literally shrink, which I find fascinating. And well, this matters because we need to learn how to adjust as an economy. We need to be prepared. From an economics perspective, when we think about demography, we often go immediately to pension systems. But in reality, it's much more than just that. It's labor force participation rates. It's informal care, formal care, what we call the long-term care system. And this impacts pretty much the whole labor dynamics. And so when we take a closer look at Europe, we have to think that the baby boomer generation will start to retire soon. And this, together with an aging population, we're going to have a huge increase in the share of old people to working age population. So this is expected to increase by 20 percentage points from what it is today in 30 years. And if we already have labor shortages in the long-term care system already today, and we saw this vividly with COVID, this is going to be even more pronounced 20 years from now or 30 years from now, even more 70 years from now. As an example, if we're going to have a huge surge in the very old population, and what I mean by very old population, I mean population older than 85 years old, which is typically when people are starting to be in need of getting help to perform their basic daily activities. When we look at this share of the population, we can see data tells us that almost half of this population needs help, needs long-term care help. So this means that there's going to be both a surge in demand for these long-term care systems, but also shortages in supply. And we need to adjust. And when we need to adjust, we need to think about how we're going to increase supply, but also how are we going to possibly try to reduce demand. And what we do is we try to look at these several demographic projections, but also health scenarios. And what we're doing here in our research at Bruegel is we're trying to look at different demographic projections because, of course, these numbers vary based on several assumptions. And we play a little bit with these assumptions. We see what happens if we assume a bit of a higher fertility rate, a bit of a lower, higher migration, lower migration. So we play a little bit with these scenarios to see how this share of older population will look like relatively to the share of working population. What we see is that despite of the scenarios, despite of the assumptions, how we play with the data, the trend is very clear. Population is aging by fact, despite of the assumptions, in even the most optimistic scenario. And so knowing this, knowing that population is aging, knowing that working age population is shrinking, what can we do? What can we look at? What is exogenous from a policy perspective? before taking this step, we try to see how are people aging? Are people aging in a healthy way? Are people aging worse? Because we see that life expectancy keeps increasing, but we need to also take into account how are these additional years of life spent? Are they healthy? Are they not healthy? Are these people that are living longer going to be in need of help for more years or the same? Is it proportional? And what we see is that the data tells us that while there's an increase in life expectancy, this is not necessarily followed by healthy years. The OECD estimated that out of these additional years of life that are being lived, a third of them are lived in need of care, in need of help. So these are not healthy years. As a next step, we also try to play a little bit with these health assumptions. So we look at scenarios where people are aging more healthily, where people are aging less healthily, what we call the morbidity rates. We play a little bit with this. And what we see is that despite the fact that we're still going to have a much older population, we do see that there is some scope for improvement, whether these people are aging healthier or not. And so this is something that we're trying to look at. How can we reduce demand by trying to incentivize healthy aging policies? And we need to start thinking about this.
Thanks very much. I want to hear more about that later on. And just to get us started, I do really appreciate how you brought up quality of life, because it's not just that the baby boomers are retiring. It's that as they get older, they may have to phase out of independent life. And that transition will be at least as hard for society and for them as leaving formal workplace employment. But speaking of employment, we have a new technology that is raising all of the age-old questions about transformational, generational, technological change. That's artificial intelligence. Tilman, tell us about AI and what you're thinking about.
Yeah, I'm very happy to do so. Thanks also from my side for being here. So I thought a bit about how to motivate this question, because my impression is really that to many people, AI really feels overexposed as a topic in modern discourse. So there's a lot of talk about the AI hype and AI bubble. Sort of that being said, I think it's important to recognize that the underlying capability story is really a real one, right? So when you look back in 2019, OpenAI released its GPT-2 model. That's sort of the predecessor to the GPT-3 model, which was then the underlying model for ChatGPT, which also surprised us in 2022 so much. And that could barely sort of formulate one paragraph of text, right? A coherent paragraph of text. And then sort of 3 years later from then, we saw ChatGPT. In the same year, Google DeepMind released a model, and they essentially solved a 50-year-old grand challenge in biology, namely how proteins fold based on the underlying amino acid sequence. And now 3 years from now, or 4 years from now, we have reasoning models, which are basically able to tackle a lot of PhD-level questions in a lot of scientific fields. So I think to recognize this, that the intelligence of these models is actually growing exponentially, is sort of maybe the starting point of my argument. The bottom line is that we were basically surprised multiple times, and I think that we should keep on sort of expecting to be surprised again. And that's because the underlying inputs, namely computing power, algorithms, and data, which are sort of the underlying ingredients for building an AI model, they are likely to increase further. A lot of the computing power that will drive the next generation of AI models is actually already being paid for. We all know of the staggering investments that are being done by big tech these days in hundreds of millions, billions of dollars into data centers. There are still sort of text data or usable text data seems to, by now, reach a certain limit. There's still a lot of, modal data, such as video, voice, and sort of also sensory data, right, that you get from interacting with the real world, essentially, is still available and can train further models. And algorithms also keep on surprising us, sort of these advances in reasoning models, right? The idea that AI models can have chains of thoughts and can reason stepwise was the latest breakthrough. And I'm actually fairly certain that, these breakthroughs will continue to happen. And that being said, I think as of now, institutional awareness is really not where it should be. There will be great challenges coming with this. You mentioned labor markets. I think that that's a big one. I think one good example is biosecurity. So general purpose AI systems are fairly good at developing biochemical agents, at developing chemical weapons. As of now, we mostly rely on, the tech firms themselves to impose guardrails, safeguarding us from that. cybersecurity, also Claude Mythos coming out more recently, and that has not been sort of been made accessible to many European players. So Europe is essentially out of this conversation. I think there are great national security threats coming with it. And the point is basically, while AI feels hyped, I think our institutions are in fact underprepared for what is to come.
Thank you so much for that. Underprepared for what is to come is a familiar theme when it comes to AI in so many different directions. Before we come back to that, Teo, you came to Bruegel specifically to work on China issues. I understand you speak Chinese, and I would love to hear your thoughts about the long-term issues that we're dealing with here, and not just the short-term, who's up, who's down, and who's putting a tariff on what.
Absolutely. And Rebecca, thank you for having us. It's really, really lucky for me to work at Bruegel with such amazing researchers and colleagues, and to work on China in particular, at a moment when China is rising in the world so quickly, developing its innovation capacity so rapidly, and the externalities that are produced by this changing world are really difficult to deal with for the EU and for other partners across the world. So in looking at China in the context of European relations, you know, it's a partner that has such a growing trade imbalance, and that has an impact on European markets, on European jobs, particularly in the industrial sector, where China is just so great at manufacturing so many of the products that we use across the world, and growingly so, from 30% of global manufacturing right now to what is projected to grow over in the next 10 years. So this relationship is complicated, not just by China's economic development, but also its propensity to use economic sanctions and leverage, including export bans for things like critical raw materials, these inputs, these ingredients we need for our products. It does this sometimes in protest of political problems, and this can really cause issues for what we hope to be a rules-based international order of remediating these issues through international mechanisms like the WTO, for example. And, of course, it has a close relationship with Russia that, since 2022, its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, has become a real hard security threat to the EU, and this further complicates EU-China relations. So, in understanding the story of China, there's lots of places to start and lots of places to go, and some of them were touched on in this very podcast, including the demographic story. With China's ballooning population in the second half of the 20th century and the measures that it took to address this, including the famous one-child policy, which was relaxed lately. But what we see in comparing China's demographic development across time is that it actually matches quite closely with what you see with other countries that are experiencing raised standards of living, more employment of women and participation of women in the workforce. And that's that fertility rates go down. And right now, you're at a point where China's overall fertility rate is below replacement level, and in some places, far below replacement level. And so we're seeing China try to grapple with this problem, just like other countries across the world, by instituting incentives for families to have children, and particularly for women to be able to manage and not sacrifice sort of career opportunity with having children, with having a family. But it's nowhere near enough. Just like many countries across the world, we see financial incentives that don't come near to touch what's required. And this grows more complicated by the fact that China's per capita GDP, so the sort of average income of Chinese people in the country, is still actually comparatively quite low. And so you have this situation where if there's not enough workers to be able to sustain Chinese families across the world, the economy can sort of start having these more serious issues over time. There's people that have described China's demographic situation as a demographic time bomb. And it's very, very difficult for not just China, but countries across the world, including European countries, to deal with this issue. Part of what we see is that in addressing this, AI has become an incredibly sort of linchpin issue, where it's seen as a way to not just sort of increase productivity across the economy so that you get more bang for your buck, more products from your work, but also as a way to create jobs and replace the ones that are no longer going to even be staffed by a shrinking population. China's population is now shrinking. This is something that China's focused on with incredible energy through things like AI plus manufacturing. It's a policy that China's instituted to include AI for more efficient industrial models, but also through its innovation space, which is something that we're looking on quite a bit at Bruegel, is how China innovates in AI, particularly for its industrial sector. And so what we find is an innovation model that's able to, in some ways, be the little engine that could, dealing with export bans on the most powerful computing chips from the United States, and still manage to bring out some of the most efficient, some of the most cutting-edge artificial intelligence models based on its own domestic innovation and its distillation of models that were produced elsewhere. This is an incredible change and an incredible upset in some ways for this innovation race that we're in. But fundamentally, we haven't even touched on some of the most important ways that China impacts the global economy and European relations. It is a quote-unquote megatrend. It's something that it is a country that is impacting the European Union, not just from an economics perspective, a demographic lesson, an industrial innovator, a security issue, but also in terms of a renewable transition. That's something that I'm not sure we'll have time to talk about in this. But what I'm getting at is that China's impact on Europe and its importance to European interests is multifold and growing over time. And so I consider myself incredibly lucky to work at Bruegel in a capacity to be able to deal with these issues and look at these issues every single day and work with some of the smartest people in the field in that work.
We are very excited to have all of you here at Bruegel because it's that group vibe that leads to us being able to come up with the ideas that we have. To bring together a couple of the things we've just heard, on demographics, we certainly saw that during the baby boom years, there was a ton of teen pregnancy. There were a ton of families who began because there were no options. There was not good birth control. There was not the ability to choose the timing of when you had kids. And there was, in some parts of the world, what they called the baby scoop era, where teenagers were forced to have these babies if they managed to get pregnant. And then the babies were taken away from them. They weren't given the resources they needed to raise them in their own family units if that was what they wanted. Now we are moving, hopefully, to a global society where men and women together can decide when is the best time to form their families and to continue the trend we saw in the 20th century of not just having more children, but wanting more for those children. So instead of having 8 kids, maybe you have 2 and they both go to college and have more choices for what they do. As we talk about demographics, I think keeping in mind the opportunities as well as just the costs and the incentives is really important, because if you just take away other options for women and try to imply that they don't have any choice but to have lots of kids, you don't necessarily get to a good part of society. Katharina, can you say more about how uncertainty affects these decisions? So many families say, we'd love to have kids, maybe we have enough money, but we're just not sure that the equilibrium we have now will last. And in 10 years, we don't want to have kids and not be able to take care of them.
Thank you, Rebecca, for your question. I think that a lot changed. And I think this has to do with urbanization, with labor force participation rates. And I think these are all great things. These are all great achievements. And I don't think this is something that we should be aiming to touch upon. I think that a major change was that maybe 100 years ago or 50 years ago, children were perceived by their families as an asset, especially in lower income countries where people had more children to have more money. And in some economies, it was even the case of the so typical missing women, where if they didn't have a boy as a baby, the baby would be somehow discarded in ways we don't even imagine. So I think these are great improvements that we have achieved. I don't think we should necessarily aim for higher fertility rates. I think that what we should aim for is perhaps how to adjust as an economy for this new shift in demographics and role of participation.
Thanks. What do you think this means for Europe specifically, Katharina?
I think we're going to be facing a great challenge. I think there's a transitional period for which we are not prepared. We are underprepared in several ways, both for pension sustainability regards, even infrastructure for the elderly people. Cities are not prepared to have people with functional impairment limitations or disabilities. And I think this is going to be a lot to take in such little time, with the world changing in so many different ways, in so many different geopolitical challenges. I think this is often being disregarded and we need to act fast. We need to start.
Thanks. Tilman, I want to ask you, Europe is often seen as caught in the middle between China, the manufacturing powerhouse, and the US, where you have these deep capital markets and these AI firms that have come to dominate global finance as well as global technology. What does Europe do here?
So Europe is not doing a lot, I'm afraid. It is doing something. I don't want to disregard that. But in what is sometimes called the AI race between China and the US, I think it's fair to characterize Europe rather as a laggard. I mentioned before computing power as sort of a key ingredient to building frontier AI models. And when it comes to computing power and sort of the large data centers that host them, the US and China make up the lion's share of computing power that really exists today in the world. I don't have the numbers right now in front of me, but I think it's roughly something between the US having about 60 to 70% of the global computing power, China has roughly 20 or so, and Europe in aggregate has perhaps 5. That being said, I mean, there still are some European champions in the AI race, right? So there's Mistral AI as sort of one company in Europe that competes somewhere at the frontier. They're not at the very cutting edge, but they're somewhere close. I have a specific focus on computational power. One reason is that compute is somewhat more governable than data and algorithms are. And for my research, I can also speak of further downstream the development of these chips that ultimately drive these data centers. And in terms of that, Europe also doesn't really have a lot of infrastructure in that respect. Most of the chips that are being used in modern AI data centers are being produced in Taiwan. As of now, they are designed in the US, mostly by NVIDIA. That's not to say that Europe doesn't really have any assets. Most importantly, there's the lithography machine maker ASML, that is to mention here. But yeah, that out of the way, I think Europe is lagging somewhat in the AI race.
How is Europe's quest to regulate this industry affecting those dynamics?
So there are different stories about why Europe's really lagging in this race. And one that you mentioned is a story about regulation. Most importantly, in the eyes of many, the AI Act, that is a fairly controversial piece of European legislation, is hindering companies of innovating at the frontier, essentially. To be honest, I'm a bit skeptical of this narrative. It might be that sort of regulation is part of the story, but really the AI Act is not that old, and leading edge tech companies that are now dominating this world, they have been around for quite a while. So I think it's hard to all point it down to the AI Act and make it sort of the core issue here. I think much has to do as well with not well-functioning capital markets in the EU and underdeveloped savings and investment union. A lot has to do with the missing 28th regime. I mean, a lot comes together. But I think overall, the story about capital being sort of the missing piece is, to me at least, a more convincing one than the one about regulation.
Thank you for that. We did a fantastic podcast on 28th regime concepts a couple weeks ago, and that, along with the bios of our today's speakers and their research, will all be available for free in the show notes. So listeners, do feel free to poke around after you're done here. Teo, I want to ask you about China as a global swing vote right now. They are seen as not aligned with anybody in particular, which can be used in ways that various actors find more helpful and ways that various actors find a little more intimidating. And that can be on everything from the Trump administration, the war in Iran, the war in Ukraine, the EU's national security and strategic autonomy aims. There's just so much where what China is going to do seems like it's holding the balance. How do we think about that?
A global swing vote. I really, really like that description of China. And I think that a lot of international actors will map onto China their respective hopes and anxieties. And China itself is trying to more and more stake out its own position in the world when it comes to an independent foreign policy, an independent economic policy. And this is taking a lot of different shapes. You see it aligning itself with what used to be called the Group of 77. This is a group of what used to be, it's now more, but used to be 77 countries of the Global South in the United Nations to create coalitions among countries that are considered to be developing countries. And it sees itself as the standard bearer of that group in the world. And so it, a lot of times on the global stage and in international organizations, will act as it says, as it portrays and sees itself in the interest of this global majority of the global South. Beyond that, though, there's some very, very complicated alliances or partnerships that China has with countries across the world, including, as I spoke about before, with Russia, but also with a lot of other regimes, which the EU and other Western countries may not have such great relations with. Most famously, you hear the understanding of China's relationships with partners in the Global South as transactional, as having no strings attached. Now, while I think that's a little controversial and maybe not the entirety of the story, there is this idea or reality that China goes into a lot of parts of the world with ideas for infrastructure projects, with ideas for resource extraction projects, with alliance systems that they're hoping to build across the world that can help further its own interests. And they do this not under the guise of global aid programs, as you might have seen previously from the United States or from several other countries, but very, very explicitly as we are here for business, for mutual benefit. And we are of a unified mind that there are other development pathways than those that are being proposed by the West. There's a lot of appetite for that idea across the world. And so you see loan programs that are built across the world under this umbrella of China's Belt and Road Initiative, for example, which is just one of several global initiatives that it's trying to wrangle throughout the world, or I shouldn't say wrangle, that is proponing across the world in partnership with lots of countries, and to great effect, to great effect. When we talk about the governance of certain controversial issues, including how to govern AI, China is revealing itself to also be stepping up to the plate in trying to design rules of the game, essentially how AI can be used for the benefit of mankind, as it says in its policy documents. And this is coming specifically at a moment when the United States, the previous hegemon, is sort of taking a step back in sort of returning to a more isolationist foreign policy. So when talking about China as a swing vote, a lot of times countries in the global south will see it as a partner and as a loan maker, a market creator for their resource extraction for their products, while other countries may see it more as a geopolitical rival, as a systemic rival, as the EU put it in 2019, a tripart description of how it sees China, but a systemic rival, that this is a system that's been shown to work to great effect within China and elsewhere. And how do we reckon with that when we are the representatives of a model that has also been shown to work, of liberal democratic institutions, of global governance? How do we sort of square that circle and make these things fit together? It's very difficult for policymakers across the world, and it's an incredibly interesting time to be looking at China.
Tillman, if China is setting the rules of the game in many parts of the world, what does that do for the so-called Brussels effect, where Brussels tried to be a first mover on regulation in hopes of shifting global attitudes on tech, on climate, and things like that?
Speaking of regulation in China, I think it's good to mention China is also heavily regulating its AI use. Do you agree with this statement, Theo?
Absolutely. And particularly when it comes to generative AI, where there's lots of regulation and less so for AI that's used for, say, the optimization of a factory floor. But absolutely, it's regulating AI a lot.
So having that out of the way, I think in that regard, China is also a good case in point for the argument that I made earlier about how regulation might not be the key hindrance for developing leading edge AI models, right? Talking about the Brussels effect, so I got to say that the export of AI rules made in China to the rest of the world are not sort of my greatest field of expertise as of now. That out of the way, the Brussels effect with respect to the AI Act has so far at least been somewhat disappointing. At least that's sort of the commentary that I have read about it. So I think as we progress more towards a world in which AI really has a lot of political salience and gets a lot of attention, I think those who are really sort of the countries that really are at the frontier of AI development prefer not to have their AI development being regulated too much from outside, right? I think the Brussels effect works quite well when you have topics that are, you know, less politically salient, say, for instance, the GDPR. I mean, that's sort of a great success story of the Brussels effect. When it comes to AI, I'm somewhat less skeptical whether, for instance, the US government is so willing to let the way it governs AI being dictated by the EU, at least in the world that we are living today. It's an interesting question that you pose, Rebecca, about where China factors into all of this. I'm not sure. Theo, do you have a good answer on sort of the export of AI rules from China to the rest of the world?
Sure. So a lot of times China will be instituting these principles. So not so much trying to institute real regulations to export across the world, but more in the form of agreements on principles for the ethical governance of AI. And it's proposed just that, although I can't remember the name of this document that was featured about a year or two ago. In the technology itself for the, say, infrastructure to be able to install AI systems for governance across the world, we see China really, really stepping out into the global south to bring to the global south affordable systems of AI and the infrastructure that's required to be able to host those systems. Now, this comes, as you might expect, with a lot of issues that are intuitive, where we talk about the security implications of having AI systems that are installed by China across the world or used by countries across the world that may not always be treating their citizens all that well. What this makes for is a situation where China is in a prime position to be able to get access to one of the most important components of AI, which is data, where in establishing and gaining access to data that's being generated by the Global South and regulating the use of these things, China finds a new edge that it can have on the global competition for the development of these systems. It's very interesting and very complicated for a lot of these countries across the world to navigate because you're caught between a rock and a hard place. Do you choose to forego the development of your AI systems, or do you open yourself up to an accessible but maybe difficult and conditioned use of Chinese AI with all of the security and other implications that go along with that?
Thanks. In the next part of our podcast, I want to step back a little bit and talk about the future. Frankly, you guys have much more of your careers ahead of you probably than I do or than other people on this podcast do. And I would like to hear from each of you why you chose this field, at least for this part of your lives, and what you hope personally you can be part of and what you think generally economists and public policy people can do.
Thank you, Rebecca. I really like that question. Well, sometimes it feels a bit of a dead-end job that we chose because I feel like as economists, we're all trying to answer the big questions when in reality, there's so little we can really answer. But I think that if we can answer just a tiny bit, just 1%, if there's something that we can see ahead of ourselves, I think that's already something. That's already an impact. And I think that's already something that motivates me a lot on a personal level to be in this field and to do research. To try to be very ambitious to answer the big questions, but instead answering the little ones. But step by step, if we answer the little ones one at a time, it's already a big conquer, I would say.
Yeah, I like that framing as well. I think there's a lot of uncertainty coming forward where we're going with the world. I think anyone claiming that we really know 10 years from now where we will stand is probably overconfident. I think we might know a bit better with respect to demographics where we will stand in a couple of years from now than we perhaps know today where we stand with respect to AI or China in 10 years from now. But I think sort of one unifying theme might be that it's really important for governments and institutions to prepare themselves for these challenges that are ahead. I think also prepare for a wide range of outcomes that might materialize in the future and build really robust institutional architecture that can handle these diversity of potential outcomes that it might lay ahead.
So I really agree with that. And I felt a lot of sympathy with the idea that we are unable to answer these very, very large questions. But if we can impact change on even the tiniest of levels when it comes to policymaking or the direction of travel for these questions, then you know what? That's a life well lived. And I think as young researchers, we still have maybe naively some of that belief that we can actually impact change on even the smallest of levels. And that drives us. And so for me in particular, with China rising in the world, if I can even help move the discussion and policymaking one step closer towards a more fruitful, mutually beneficial relationship with China, then I can die a happy man.
You know, I don't think that's naive. And I think that the vast majority of us in this policy space are here because we do hope we can make the world, or at least our patch of the world, a better or more effective or more efficient space. And certainly when we're working, I know when I'm working on some of these narrow questions, like, I don't know, capital markets and securitization or things like that, it's just a piece, but you hope that you can get this piece as good as it can be to contribute to a bigger whole. Something I think we have in common. Let me ask you about the planet. There is a huge debate right now about whether the climate scare is going to turn out like the population scare and be a thing that in 15 years we're like, wow, remember when we were worried about that? Or whether it's going to be such a dramatic change that we won't remember what it was like to even have questions about it. How do you approach climate change in your fields and in your work and in your outlook?
Well, from a demographics perspective, there are actually some scholars that are quite optimistic about the population decline precisely because it will be beneficial for the planet, because it's the humans that are causing ultimately the climate change, right? So there are some positive feedbacks on this regard, and I really like to hold on to this because we often look at the scary part of the population decline, and I think we're going to transition through a very hard period, as I mentioned before. But I think that if we make it a transition period, maybe a couple of years, maybe we won't be here, most likely not. But I believe that's something positive to look upon.
Yeah, I think there's an obvious and important link between AI and environmental challenges. Training an AI model and doing inference on an AI model is incredibly energy intensive. And if that energy comes from dirty carbon sources, then that's bad for the environment, and that's something that should be talked about and discussed. Data centers also need a lot of water to cool their systems. That can be sort of a challenge in water scarce regions. So no questions asked about that. That being said, many of the questions with respect to AI are very pressing in time. For instance, when it comes to biochemical agents being developed with AI systems, that's actually a threat that can materialize within the next 1 or 2 years, right? So a very imminent threat, which I think means that for a lot of people in the policy sphere, environmental issues tend to, you know, often take sort of a second step. I'm not sure if this is always sort of a good thing. I think it's important to talk about the environmental effects of AI. There are also some people who think that AI could be a net positive in our battle against environmental change, right? Some people think that AI could be of great use in research, and we recently have endorsed Claude Code within the organization, and we can already see how AI enhances productivity in research. If that is helping with finding innovative solutions and fighting climate change, I'm excited about it. Yeah, recognize the challenges, that's a big one. Maybe also think about positive effects that AI can have in our battle against climate change. And don't lose sight of the very imminent challenges that are laying ahead. I think these are my three takes.
So in talking about China from the issue of a global transition towards renewable energy sources, I always like to describe it as the keystone. So a keystone in a bridge is that one stone that holds the whole thing up. And without it, the rest might collapse. And I describe China as the keystone of our global transition towards renewable energies because I think that it is absolutely indispensable for the development and implementation of actual renewable energy infrastructure. That takes the form of wind turbines and solar and EV batteries for cars. There are infinite ways that China has become the global leader in the development of renewable technologies, and we cannot do without it. There are incredibly difficult and important questions about how to manage that flow of Chinese-produced, say, solar panels or wind turbines or EV cars. But we understand that in some ways, China actually makes the transition towards renewables physically possible through its manufacturing prowess. There's no other country in the world that's able to produce EVs, for example, on the scale and price that China is able to do that, despite all of the issues that we are very aware of come with this overcapacity. On the same note, there is no other country that's able to create power transition lines the way China is able to do, these long-distance power transmission lines that are able to take power generated in the furthest, farthest stretches of the Chinese deserts in Inner Mongolia all the way down to its production centers in the south in Guangdong province. There is no country that's able to produce these solar panels on the scale and price that China is able to do it. In fact, it is now dealing with the problems of having such low prices in that area in particular. So when I think about China in the frame of a renewable transitions, I call it the keystone because I don't see us being able to succeed in transitioning towards a better, more sustainable, cleaner economy without China. And the challenge then comes with managing that relationship so that, again, it is mutually beneficial. And I think that we're capable of it. It's just going to be difficult.
How do you all see the United States, both in the dramatic changes of its role in the world since Donald Trump became a big player in U.S. politics, and also its role going forward?
I feel like I should start on that one because you might hear it in my voice, but I am from the U.S. My dad is American. My mom is French. I grew up in the family of an American diplomat. I have grown up believing and still do believe in American values, and they have shaped my life and continue to. So in seeing the United States take a tack of isolationism, confrontation on the global stage, I can't help but be sad. But also I understand that this is part of America's history. This is just as much a part of who we are as a country than anything else. There is famously the instance where after building the first institution of global governance, the League of Nations, through Wilson's 14 points, that the United States stepped out of it, did not participate in establishing the League of Nations after World War I, and that this was part of its downfall. The United States goes through this pendulum swing of isolationism and internationalism. And I think that when we are at the best of who we are, we can step into the global stage and be leaders in our values, and that sometimes the pendulum swings the other way. And in those moments, we need to take care of one another and understand one another and rebuild, especially on our 250th anniversary coming up this year, rebuild the bonds of brotherhood that we've lost.
As a dual national myself, with generations of history going both ways of immigration to and from Europe, I very much ascribe to that optimism that the U.S. can at its best be a constructive actor on the world stage and hopefully will be in the future. Tillman and Katharina, what do you think?
Right. So I think the Americans are an incredibly important actor in respect to AI, right? So they currently host the leading AI companies in the world with Anthropic and OpenAI. It's incredibly important that Europe remains in conversation with the US. That being said, I think the continent and the EU as an institution must also acknowledge sort of the changing reality that has come about us. AI in particular has become a matter of geopolitics, essentially. So I think most obviously visible with respect to the export controls that the US has imposed with respect to China, for instance. These export controls also affect Europe by now. That being out of the way, I think it's important that Europe also gains a stake in this conversation about AI, and that it's not sort of a conversation that is just being drawn out by the US alone or by the US and China in conversation, right? And that means creating, at best, sort of companies that can compete somewhat at the AI frontier. That means building out capacity to train and do inference on these models. I think it's a bad scenario in the future when we in Europe really rely fully on data centers that are in the US for inference or training of AI models, and perhaps also gain a greater stake in the value chain of chip manufacturing to somewhat have sort of a voice. Yesterday, the Commission proposed a tech sovereignty package. I think that's a great start. I haven't really had the time to look into the nitty-gritty of it. I think it's somewhat on track on sort of realizing that AI and tech has become a more geopolitical instrument, and that sort of its relationship vis-a-vis the United States has also changed and is changing even further.
Well, I really liked Theo's framing of the pendulum that the US keeps going from closing himself, opening itself to closing and opening internationally. And I think that this seems to be a cycle, right, in history, and it seems to be repeating. History repeats itself. What I do think is that, well, I'm biased, but looking up at the demographics perspective, I think it's quite sad that in this point of the history, the US is closing itself to population inflows. They have mass deporting programs of migrants. And I think that in the long term, this is going to pose even a bigger threat for the US, for labor markets, with regards to all of the challenges that we mentioned here today, from labor market shortages to pension sustainabilities. And I think it's a shame that the US is not betting in its future. Well, then again, we don't know if these challenges will remain all of the same with the AI productivity. maybe Tilman, I don't know if you have a stand on it, whether labor productivity will not be as necessary or will it be replaced by AI. But I do think it will be a challenge regardless, at least in some dimensions.
Yeah, I think productivity is an interesting one. So economists have tried to get a grasp of the productivity effects of AI. I think these studies have problems. They come to nice conclusions and numbers as of now. But I think, so first, they are mostly concentrating on microeconometric studies, very small settings. And it's not clear sort of how you can infer from that to the macroeconomic level. So that's one big thing. And the second one being that sort of it's really unclear where the trajectory of AI is going from here, where we stand with AI models in 10 years from now, what kind of productivity effects they will enable. So I'm a bit skeptical whether we can already infer a lot from the studies that we have today on productivity effects, on what this will look like in the future. But that out of the way, looking at the trajectory of AI development over the past years, I would be very surprised if we don't see large productivity gains within the foreseeable future due to AI. And in that sense, sure, rising productivity can be one answer to a decline in birth rates and changing demographics, and perhaps also an answer to China's challenges.
We're coming to the end of our time. So to wrap up, I'll ask each of you a two-part question, but you can answer in part or in whole as you're so moved. The question is, what is something that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked you but should have? And or what is something you wish that policymakers close to the end of their careers would keep in mind when looking after the generations that come next?
Well, first on the second part, for policymakers, I think that there are forces of inertia that happen where particular dialogues get entrenched when it comes to international relations in particular. And I see this with China. And I think that a lot of times, what I wish I could see from policymakers was an acknowledgement and internalization of this reality that across the world, young people and families, everyone, just about, wants the same thing. We want health. We want prosperity. We want education. We want safety. We want, frankly, love and happiness, social bonds. And I think that with these dialogues that are incredibly important and difficult, and I do believe that a lot of policymakers, most, the vast majority of policymakers have good intentions at heart, you get caught up, I've seen, in these forces of inertia, of dialogue, of direction that become cycles that are difficult to stop. And the reality is most of society is removed from that. And I wish that policymakers would internalize that more. That we all, at the end of the day, want the same things.
Thank you, Theo, for putting it so beautifully. I couldn't do it better myself. Well, I will also start from the second question, Rebecca, because in fact, the second question was exactly the answer to the first one as well. With regards to my work and the work that some of our colleagues here at Bruegel have done here, when we're talking about demography and when we're talking about this long-term care sector, one thing that it's often overlooked, but our colleagues brilliantly brought up so, was that if we underinvest in the long-term care system, we might also be hindering the progress that we have made in achieving higher female labor participation rates. And this is because when we have a care gap, usually, so by the care gap, I mean the difference in the supply and demand of this sector, usually we use informal care supply. And this informal care supply is largely supported by women. And so if we underinvest in this long-term care sector, we're going to be driving this informal sector even more. And this might mean that women will participate less in a formal way to the market, which poses a threat to these big achievements that we have made and we keep making. And of course, this is not just a matter for female participation in labor forces, but also pension sustainabilities again, because then you will have less taxpayers and so on and so forth. So I think this is a bigger issue than not having enough people to take care of one of the others. With regards to what Theo was saying, that we all want the same, we all want health, we all want to be safe, equality. So I think this is a bigger issue that we often look upon that I would like policymakers to have in mind.
Although I had more time to think about a good answer than the two of you, I feel like I can't find as great words as the two of you did. I think I really don't have much to offer besides a bit of a cliche. You know, I understand that sort of day-to-day matters and policy issues that arise are important and need to be dealt with. That being said, I think it's really important that our institutions prepare for the grand challenges that lie ahead. And I would really sort of ask for these policymakers to really set up the necessary institutional awareness and state capacity to tackle these burning questions for the future.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by the fantastic Teo Storella, Maria Caterina Luro, and Tilman Schenk. We have been talking about the future of economics as a profession, also demographics, AI, and China, among other things. And you can find our research on these areas by our scholars, some of them in the show notes and all over our website, Bruegel.org. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.